Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back here talking about all things to do with disaster preparedness and response. And I wouldn't be an episode of the Disaster Podcast if I wasn't accompanied by my good friend Sam Bradley, who is dealing with a bit of an uproar of her own over the last week or so. And we'll talk about that later on in this episode. But Sam, it's good to have you here and glad you're safe.
Well, thank you. Yes, beautiful Northern California, which we've kind of disaster central right now. And there's still shaking going on. So we will talk about it. And fortunately, we have our good friend, Dr. Joe Holly here, who we love having here. And I'm sure he'll have some very good input on what we're going to talk about.
Excellent.
Well, it's good to be here as always, guys. Sam, we're definitely glad to hear you have survived the quakes in recent days, and hopefully that will settle down very quickly out there.
Well, we can only hope.
So we're talking about the Napa quake, or quakes, because there's been aftershocks and a variety of magnitudes. But this was, came in that it happened somewhat in the middle of the night. And maybe, Sam, since you were there, why don't you describe the details? And for those that maybe aren't acquainted with all of the details and what you what your experience was like.
Well, it woke me up. As much as I call it the Napa quake, because that was the seat of the most severe damage, it was actually centered in American Canyon, which is actually about 20 miles south of Napa. And I've been hearing recently there was also a considerable amount of damage in Vallejo, which was south of that, Vallejo is about 34 miles from me, and American Canyon is about 42 miles, so it's not that far. But it was enough to wake me up. And, it's funny when you're a disaster person how you kind of make mental notes to yourself. Okay, it's an earthquake. What does it feel like? I'm counting the seconds as to how long it lasted. I looked at the clock. It was 3:20 by my clock, or 3:30. So it took about 10 minutes for it to roll down from where it started. That's the way I figure. And then I went back to sleep, as we tend to do. You know, when I'm thinking later, I'm going, well, why didn't it occur to me to want to know where that, it was okay here. So you're kind of assuming it's a small one, but where did it start and how much damage was done? So I didn't really find a lot of that out until the next morning.
It's interesting because, when I first saw it, it said magnitude 6 or so, and there wasn't a whole lot of reports of damage initially, but as we look back upon it now, all the news reports and the injuries and things that were associated with it. But one of the things that surprised me, and it's something we don't think about a whole lot, but timing, time of day has a lot to do with the types and frequency of injuries seen in a lot of different disasters, whether it be a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake. It occurred to me hearing about this because it happened at night and people weren't outside walking on the streets or sidewalks that they weren't hit by crumbling masonry, for instance, that they would have been if this had happened at lunch hour.
Absolutely. And especially in an earthquake, when you're talking about people being on bridges and overpasses and God knows, in that respect, we were very, very fortunate. As of the latest I've heard, there are about 70. Now, Napa is an older town. So I think to some extent, it probably has a lot more unreinforced masonry than a lot of areas do. It reminds me of the Whittier quake, which I'll mention later. But so far, I've heard there were about 70 buildings that have been red tagged, another 200 yellow tagged. And I was going to ask Joe to expand on that. Being a USAR guy, he would kind of know the difference. Now, red tag, as I understand it, means you can't go in there. There's enough destruction that it's dangerous to be in the building. But what about a yellow tag, Joe?
Yeah, yellow tag usually just means that there's significant damage, but that the building is not in danger of imminent collapse or in danger of collapse if there's another small earthquake or aftershock.
Okay.
So, you can be in there, but things may still fall on you, but the building itself is not likely to fall on you.
Yeah, and of course, you're describing what you always get the the, you know, the video of things coming off of store shelves, and that's pretty typical. But you never know when you're going to be under any of that. But this was the biggest quake to hit since Loma Prieta, and that's been 25 years. They originally had it as a 6.1. It went down to a 6.0, but they've had a lot of aftershocks, and they're still coming. They've had them, you know, 3.9. And, of course, what the way they look at it is, what is the probability of a bigger one, but it incrementally goes down in time? So I think they said something about their likelihood of a magnitude 5 aftershock. The first day was 25%, and then it goes down sequentially. But one of the big concerns they're still having, especially in the face of aftershocks, is, like I say, overpasses, freeway overpasses, certainly all the bridges we have in Northern California. Now, where most of those are situated, there's not certainly as many up north because there's not as many bodies of water once you get past the upper part of the bay, fortunately. But, you know, all of the roadway overpasses and all of that are of concern. So Caltrans has been out there inspecting those quite a bit. And every time there's an aftershock, they have to go out there. And I don't know what you guys do in the Midwest, Joe, but when we have an event like this, it's standard policy for all fire departments to take all the apparatus out of the station and, you know, in case there's a bigger event, because there's always a concern there's a foreshock, where the apparatus and or the guys would be trapped under there. And then they go about and they kind of do some surveillance in their district to see, you know, what kind of damage they may find. Is that something you find typical in your area, is, you know, when you do have a quake?
I won't say typical. It's certainly, it's part of policy, but, our significant earthquakes in this region are pretty rare. Unfortunately, when they seem to hit here, they just seem to be really bad.
Yeah.
They're not quite as common occurrence, and therefore, you know, the preparation level, I suppose, is probably not as good as it should be. Or at least the awareness level is probably not as good as it should be, because it doesn't happen for a long time. So
yeah, well, that's pretty much standard operating procedure out here, again, because we don't want the stations coming down on the apparatus, and of course it can't get out there and help other people. But so I was surprised that there were as many injuries as there were. There were about 200 people treated. And, of course, our EMS systems here are very good about having disaster plans, and the hospitals are very good about managing those kinds of things. Fortunately, there were no deaths. There was a 13-year-old who was injured by a fireplace falling. He did suffer some pelvic fractures, but it sounds like he's doing fine. Now, one other factor here is this corresponded with the start of school. So that turned out to be somewhat unfortunate, because just as school was scheduled to start, they had to close the schools, and we're not quite sure when they're going to come up again, because, of course, they have to go around and actually check all the buildings for safety and that kind of thing. But what, I guess it shouldn't have been a surprise, but almost immediately the state did consider a disaster area, so now they can start getting resources and funding in to do some of the damage control. They have FEMA. They're working with FEMA already. Of course, I'm having heartburn over the fact that Napa is one of the main places we get our wonderful California wine. And I got to wonder if the wine prices aren't going to go up. But, you know, that's just me. But, you know, when you're thinking about a lot of the other sequela of this kind of thing, they had like 90 water main breaks. And I don't know about your area, Joe, but one of the things we face out here, I would think it would be similar because of your bodies of water there, but this thing called liquefaction, where buildings become very unstable and topple over simply because the soil becomes so saturated with the high water tables that they literally just kind of fall over. Didn't you say you deal with that out there as well?
Indeed, we do. As a matter of fact, it's probably worse here than it is in your part of the country just because of the soil makeup. So it's a huge issue for the Mississippi River Valley, which is all silt pretty much. And, you take that very sandy soil and you vibrate it very aggressively and it becomes like water, and literally things sink into it. So certainly it leads to lots of building collapse and significant damage to infrastructure.
Well, here's something you guys may be interested in that I didn't know. And I was reading one of the news reports and said, you know, what would you do if you had a 10 or 15 second warning that an earthquake was about to hit? They actually are testing a program. And they did, in fact, for the people that were testing this process. They did send out a 10-second warning just before the quake, and it did get to those people. And apparently it works off of GPS. I mean, they're working on the fact that they might be able to know exactly where you are, such that, you know, what is the danger to you being in that specific area, and how many seconds will you have to react? And of course, we know that even only a few seconds can make a huge amount of difference. You're in the middle of the street, you're up on a ladder, you're using heavy machinery, whatever it might be. So they actually were testing this product, and it actually worked. They said 10 or 15 seconds would be critical to first responders and people in dangerous workplaces. What do you think?
Well, you're exactly right. This was a trial of an early warning system. You know, I think certainly it makes a huge difference to folks that are in potentially dangerous positions, even a few seconds to get yourself in a more secure spot or at least hold on could be a huge advantage. That's modeled after some similar programs in Japan, who of course has lots of earthquakes. Mm-hmm. And it was actually designed to allow them to do things like get the high-speed train stopped.
Oh, yeah.
Or the you know, obviously avoiding a massive disaster there. But there's a lot of talk of even being able to incorporate that 10 or 15 second warning into things like power plant and refineries, et cetera, so that it could automatically activate valves to shut off pipelines and shut down, active processes. So that if the damage were substantial, at least the valves would already be closed in the pipeline, and you'd only lose a small amount of fuel or whatever you were, whatever was in the pipe.
Yeah. So,
ideas make a huge amount of sense. You know, especially when you utilize electronic systems to do that, so it doesn't require sending a message to you and then you turning around and pressing a button to close the valves. It just goes directly to the system, and the system, goes into emergency mode and shuts off valves and shuts down processes and turns off the, furnace or whatever it is it does, and has the potential to mitigate those events pretty substantially. The algorithms that are behind that program are actually pretty sophisticated to be able to identify whether or not this is likely to be a really substantial earthquake or not, and not just a little tremor, and therefore disrupt people's lives when it's not a big thing. But I think those systems will continue to get better over time.
Well, this was saying that the USGS estimates it will cost $23 million to get the warning system completely on board in California, and it would cost another $11 million a year to maintain it. So even though lawmakers haven't approved the money, I think this might just kind of push that a little bit further up the road, because they've proven that it works. So, that's very, very cool.
Well, that's very true. If you think of the cost savings from something like that, it's not an inexpensive thing to maintain, but it's a whole lot less expensive than massive damage that might occur if pipelines weren't shut down or a high speed train went off the tracks or almost anything along those lines. Like I know one of the threats that was of great concern there is had the earthquake sort of focused its energy southward instead of northward, it was very likely to have affected many of the drinking water reservoirs that are up north of San Francisco. And obviously with California being in a huge drought right now, the last thing they would need is to lose several reservoirs full of water. The impact that could have on the population. So.
Oh, God, Joe, I hadn't even thought about that. You're right. A lot of them are up there. That would be truly devastating. And, this isn't that far north of San Francisco. They no doubt felt it.
Absolutely. So it's certainly an issue to be concerned about. My daughter lives in San Francisco and apparently too many issues with it. She didn't lose power and that sort of stuff. But clearly a bit of a wake-up call there as well.
Now, Sam, you know, I know you've been doing a lot, you know, since this was in your area of the country. We kind of deferred to you to pull up information about this. And I know you've pulled some stats together of past earthquakes and how this rates and compares. And what did you find out?
I blew off half a day doing this because it was so fascinating. I found a site that had the 25 most significant earthquakes. And interestingly, some of them go back to the 10th and 11th century. And I don't know, I guess maybe they were guesstimating because the Richter scale certainly didn't exist back then. But they were able to kind of gather what they figured was the magnitude. But some of these, the highest magnitude quake was a 9.5. And I do want to, the one I find most fascinating is the Alaska quake, which wasn't on this list, interestingly, but I want to get back to these. These actually were all over the world, China, Haiti, Japan, Italy, Indonesia, Syria. There's a couple I picked out I thought were particularly interesting. The 1923 quake in Kanto, Japan was a 7.9. Now, the interesting thing is it always isn't about the magnitude. A lot of it, like we were saying, is about the soil. It's about the composition of the buildings. It's about the density of the population. Certainly, if we're talking centuries ago, people weren't nearly as prepared. Of course, if they had grass huts, that probably wouldn't be too big a problem. But they didn't have the safeguards we're talking about. They didn't have the fire protection. And this particular one was only a 7.9, but the fire, and of course, that was an issue with our 1906 San Francisco quake, of course. That alone took the lives of 140,000 people, destroyed 447,000 homes. And then, of course, the landslides and tsunamis, they had 57 aftershocks, had an estimated deaths of 93,000 people, and had about 43,000 missing that I don't know if they ever found them or not. That's massive. And that was only a 7.9. They had another one in Italy that was only a 7.1 that claimed the lives of 100,000 to 2,000 people, 200,000 people. It just amazing. Let me see what else I have here.
Think what you're saying, Sam, is that it has to do with the side effects of the earthquake, that the preparedness really makes a huge difference in survivability.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. And think about the other things. In certain part of the country, there's going to be tsunamis. There's going to be landslides. There's going to be, they had 90 water main breaks, which they really need right now in the Napa area. All of those things are going to have a cost in some way. And up here, certainly, we can't afford to lose any water. So all those water main breaks are going to be a problem. But when you look at some of these other earthquakes, by comparison, there's all of these that they're talking about had deaths of like 200,000 to 300,000 people. I can't imagine there's some of them that wiped out two-thirds of a population of a town. I mean, we have never had anything like that. And I was really kind of surprised too. I think the largest magnitude quake we've had in California was only like a 7.9 only. But when you compare it to a 9.5, and Joe, maybe you can help me if you remember how the Richter scale works, but I think it's between each point, it's like, it's astronomical, the difference between like an 8.2 and an 8.3. Do you remember how that works?
If I remember right, it's a logarithmic scale. So yeah, each increase in point is a tenfold increase in energy.
Okay. So yeah.
So they go up very, very quickly.
And I think if it can happen today. Think back to the tsunami in Indonesia that you know wiped whole villages off the side of an island. Because you know they just didn't get the warning fast enough. It kind of snuck up on them, and how devastating that was to whole communities there. It is not hard to realize how a cascade of natural disasters following an earthquake because of liquefaction of the soil and because of failure of dams or failure of other infrastructure to protect the population or fire. Luckily, you'd like to think now with modern building codes and fire protection and things like that, that some of these things are mitigated, but certainly not canceled out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, that one came up on the list. That was in Sumatra, Indonesia in 2004, magnitude of 9.1 to 9.3 with a death toll of like 225,000 people. So I'm sure many of those were the result of the tsunami as much as the earthquake itself. I found some interesting stuff. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I was just going to say that's sort of another example of what Jamie was talking about earlier, where the environmental factors around those disasters have a huge impact, whether it's the time of day, the day of the week, you know, close to a population center, not close to a population center, offshore, and therefore the earthquake itself isn't as damaging as the tsunami, which obviously, you know, destroyed the Fukushima nuclear plant and, you know, rendered a big area in central Japan essentially uninhabitable due to, you know, radiation hazards. So they work on many different levels.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing. Like I said, this occurred in American Canyon, which is about 20 miles south of Napa, but it's pretty rural. So obviously you have much more population density in Napa, and had it been closer to Napa, it would have been significantly worse.
And that's going to wrap up this segment on the Napa earthquake. We actually split this episode into two parts because we were talking about things and really needed to continue the discussion. We'll be talking some more about earthquakes in next week's episode as we continue this discussion, and specifically about how other earthquakes that have affected the United States and even other parts of the world might have lessons to teach us here. I want to thank our partners at Paragon Medical Education Group again for their continued support here at the Disaster Podcast. You can find links to their website over at disasterpodcast.com. I urge you to head over and check out the amazing training resources that they can bring to bear for your system and help you provide better preparation for your disaster response services. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis. For Sam Bradley, Joe Holly, and the rest of the team here at Disaster Podcast, we will be back again soon. In the meantime, remember, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.